Some habits were harder to break than others. Dr. Smerling said, the brain swelling had begun to recede, so we lightened up the coma to see if he could come back. And? And we got something, Dr. Smerling said. A lot more than we expected. Chapter 40. At precisely 7 o'clock that evening, David arrived at the VA ready to get to work. As far as he knew, Carrie was already on the road, headed back to Maine. She had called with the exciting news about Sam Rockwell and suggested they reschedule tonight's activities, but David saw no need. He could get the job done as long as Carrie did her part to help. At the front desk, David almost forgot to use the alias Michael Stephen, but remembered at the last possible second, before the conversation with the receptionist turned decidedly awkward. Carrie had assured him nobody would ask for ID, and she was right. Even so, for backup, David had printed a bogus one using a template procured off the internet and had it laminated for authenticity. It proved an unnecessary precaution, but David seldom left anything to chance. Here you go, dear, the kind-faced receptionist said as she handed David his temporary badge. One obstacle cleared, thought David. He headed to the third floor, following a rudimentary map drawn from Carrie's brief description of the hospital layout. Walking these institutionalized halls, David felt suffocated at the thought of having to work in such an antiseptic environment. Journalistic stringers were free spirits, and David relished the uncertainty of his chosen profession. He was all about new possibilities and shied away from anything that could anchor him. A permanent job, a mortgage, a car, material possessions, and yes, even love. He often wondered if the issues between him and Emma were a product of mismatched pheromones or his wandering spirit. Guarded as he was, something told David one kiss from Carrie Bryant might be enough to tame his wanderlust permanently. Carrie's office was third to the last down a long hallway, lined with ordinary wooden doors without any markings on them. She had left the door unlocked, as she said she would, and David went inside. His first impression was that Carrie essentially worked in a closet. His prison cell in Syria had been only slightly bigger. She had enough room for a chair and a metal desk, which Carrie wisely kept uncluttered. A small square window offered a narrow view of a gritty construction effort underway. All in all, David found it a depressing place. He much preferred the dangers of the field. Carrie had left a pair of scrubs on the door hook, and they fit David fine. He turned the lock on the doorknob before he closed the door and checked the hallway to make sure nobody was coming. Carrie had rightly said most everyone would be gone by now, and the halls were museum quiet. From the pocket of his pants, David retrieved a leather case that contained a tension wrench and set of picks. He tested his picking chops on Carrie's door. It was open in less than a minute. Having worked in dangerous locales over the years, David had acquired a unique set of unsavory skills. In addition to picking locks, forging documents, and planting bugs, David was competent with a gun and could also hotwire some cars. Returning to the main hallway, David passed a few people on his way to Goodwin's office, but nobody gave him a second glance. The modest disguise more than sufficed. Following Carrie's directions, David took a right turn at the first hallway branch and stopped at a door with a mounted placard that read, Dr. Sandra L. Goodwin, Chief of Neurosurgery, M.D. David put his ear to the door and gave a listen. Not a sound. He gave the knob a gentle turn. Locked. Good. David had the door open in less time than it had taken to manipulate the pins on Carrie's lock. He entered quickly, closed and locked the door behind him, and flicked on the light. The office within was larger than Carrie's by a good amount, with nicer furniture and a bigger window, too. But the institutional stamp was just the same. David fished the Sonnet 21 mini voice recorder from his pocket. The device had cost $500, a fortune for David at the time, but the investment had paid back tenfold in the information covertly obtained. The voice-activated rectangular device was a bit larger than a Bic lighter, weighed just 8 grams, and could record for 120 hours on a single charge. David searched the office for the best place to hide the recorder. The Sonnet's black case blended well with the dirt of one of Goodwin's ailing plants. After he turned on the voice activation mode, David covered the recorder with a thin layer of soil to better conceal it and took a seat in Goodwin's chair. Testing, 1, 2, 3, David said in a normal speaking voice. Testing, testing. He retrieved the device, cleared away the dirt, and pressed the playback button. His voice echoed loud and clear. David returned the recorder to the pot and flicked enough dirt to make it disappear. He got halfway to the door when he heard footsteps coming down the hall. He moved behind the desk, feeling sweat beat up on his brow. The doorknob to Goodwin's office turned from the outside. David looked around for any place to hide. The ceiling tiles could be removed, but the chance of him climbing up there before the door came open was slim to none. Keys rattled. Color drained from his face. David had to act quickly, rationally. The only place he could think to hide was under the desk. He moved the chair back a foot to squeeze his body into the small crawl space underneath the desk. The desk's metal front would partly shield him from anybody walking in, but half a foot of space between the legs and the metal sides left him horribly exposed. All somebody had to do was look down, and they'd see David huddled in a little ball on the floor. To get his body off the ground, David pressed his back against one side of the desk and put his feet up against the other side. Next, he engaged his core, arched his hips, and raised his body off the floor. The strain on his stomach muscles was instant and intense. It took all of a few seconds for the spasms to begin, his midsection shaking like an earthquake. David swallowed a breath and concentrated on relaxing. He heard the key go into the lock and a slight noise as the doorknob engaged. David worried his bottom might be sagging a bit, and he lifted it up higher. The burn intensified. He heard two sets of footsteps enter, and then a man's voice. "I just need to grab a file for Sandra, and then we'll be out of here." A female voice said, "Maybe we should stay a while longer." David's heart pounded in his ears. Every muscle in his core was fully engaged, and his joints ached from the oppressive strain. The crawl space under the desk was unpleasantly cramped, but David elevated his hips some more without making a sound. Closing his eyes, he breathed through his nose and began to count in his head. 1. 2. 3. "Got it," the man said.
"I got it too, Evan," the woman said.
David heard a groan of pleasure escape Evan's lips. This had to be Evan Navarro, Goodwin's minion Carrie had told him about.
"Residents are not supposed to fraternize with their boss," Evan said in a breathy voice.
"Is squeezing and rubbing the same as fraternizing?" asked the woman.
David snapped his eyes closed and fought against the growing fatigue. Sweat poured out of his body and began to drip on the floor. Evan groaned again, and David heard the sounds of sloppy kissing. David's mind began to quit on him.
"Just give it up and drop to the floor."
He felt his grip slipping, and the desperate urge to let go intensified. His violent body shakes persisted and threatened to dislodge him.
16, 17, 18. "Maybe we should skip dinner tonight," Evan said.
"I know what I want for dessert," the woman cooed.
The kissing resumed while tears of pain streaked down David's cheeks. Both legs burned equally, and it felt like sharp needles were being jammed into his stomach. He kept his eyes closed tight and kept counting.
35, 36, 37.
David feared he might black out. He had to let go. There was no way to hold on. His body was screaming as the agony turned exquisite. The kissing sounds abruptly stopped.
"Let's take this to a more comfortable location," Evan suggested. "Please, please."
A consuming blackness came over him. David's back was slipping. His legs were giving out on him. His whole body was drenched in sweat. The traction simply was not there. He slid down an inch.
"Maybe we should do it here," the woman suggested.
A beat. David slid some more. His legs had turned to jello.
"If you want to do it in an office, let's use mine," Evan said. "I'll have visions of Sandra in my head, and that's just not a turn-on."
David dropped another inch. His back began to sag, and if somebody glanced at the floor, they would have no trouble seeing him. His lower back and hips were clearly visible.
"Let's just go to your place," the woman said. "A bed would be far more comfortable than a desk."
David heard a thunderclap sound when somebody slapped the top of the desk.
The vibration nearly dislodged him, and his body dipped even more. He kept his gaze fixed upward. A biting on his tongue helped him regain focus. Hold on. His muscles went into full spasm. David was going to drop. I can do this. Just hold on a few more seconds.
Couldn't agree more, Evan said.
In the back of his mind, through a fog of pain, David heard footsteps and the sound of a door opening. The office lights went out as David's body let go. He crashed to the floor at the same instant the office door slammed shut. Chapter 41. Seacoast Memorial Hospital was south of Bangor, overlooking beautiful Elkhorn Lake. According to Carrie's navigation app, it was a 4.5-hour drive from Boston, mostly a straight shot up I-95 North. The sameness of the route had lulled Carrie into a trance, and the classic rock station she found did a marginal job at keeping her awake and alert. She rolled down her window and took in a refreshing blast of fresh air. Sunset was approaching, and off in the distance, Carrie spotted a helicopter making lazy circles against a sky brushed with hues of pink and yellow. She figured it was a news chopper, but traffic on this stretch of highway was light, and it would have to fly elsewhere to find any congestion. On a whim, Carrie exited the highway at Brunswick and merged onto Route 1, headed north. The detour would add only 20 minutes or so to her drive, but would take her along the gorgeous scenic coastline. A few miles down the road, Carrie's phone rang and gave her a start. She checked the number, thinking it might be David with news, but the ID came up as Dr. Abby Smirling. "Hi there, Dr. Smirling," Carrie said, fumbling with the phone settings to activate her Bluetooth and make the call hands-free. "Hi, Carrie. You had asked for an update on Sam Rockwell's condition?" There was no small talk. Abby Smirling, like almost every doc Carrie knew, squeezed phone calls in the way they did meals. Carrie again braced herself for a disappointing report. "We just did his Glasgow score, and it came out a 6. Carrie's mouth fell open. A 6? She could hardly believe her ears. This was up 2 points from when she had last spoken to Smirling. The Glasgow report provided neurologists with a way to gauge the severity of an acute brain injury by measuring various functions, including eye opening, verbal response, and motor response. A patient's prognosis could be predicted with surprising accuracy. Anything 8 and above had a good chance for recovery, while a score between 3 and 5 was most likely fatal. A 6 was the netherworld. Not great, not dismal, perfectly in between. Sam Rockwell had suffered a massive hemorrhage that went below the arachnoid membrane and into the cerebrospinal fluid, according to what Dr. Smirling had told her. The hemorrhage had grown, too, in part because of a course of anticoagulant medication. The increased swelling from fluid collection around the hemorrhage site caused further pressure on the brain structure and additional neurological injury. For Rockwell to have emerged from his coma and get a 6 on the Glasgow score was about as likely as Goodwin inviting Carrie on a girls' weekend. "So what's driving the number?" Carrie asked. "We've got a little more verbal response than before, but his speech is still incomprehensible. He's a 2 there. His eyes have opened in response to pain, and he's got the same decerebrate posture as before." Based on that alone, Carrie pictured Rockwell in his hospital bed, arms and legs held straight out, his toes pointed downward, and his head and neck arched back. The abnormal posture was a sign of severe brain damage and earned him a 2 on the widely used scale. The eye movement was the new development, having gone from a +1 to a +2 in under a day. It was encouraging progress. While there was no real reason for Carrie to rush up to Maine, Rockwell's scores were not low enough to keep her from making the drive. As Dr. Smirling confirmed, his scores could improve at any time, and perhaps the verbal could get up to a 4. The conversation, in that case, might be confused, but he might be able to answer some simple questions. "Did you ever see palynacusis in the vets before? Did you notice any side effects from the DBS surgery? Did any of your patients ever go missing?" As long as there was hope for Rockwell's further improvement, Carrie could stay a day or two before her next scheduled surgery. "Well, I appreciate you keeping me in the loop," Carrie said. "I'll be up there in a few hours." Carrie ended the call, and her foot got a little bit heavy on the gas. She noticed the helicopter high up in the sky hovering like a dragonfly as it made several passes over the highway. "You're not going to find any traffic here either," she thought.
20 minutes later, Carrie made a pit stop at a roadside gas station, an oasis on a lonely stretch of road. She filled the tank and took a much-needed stretch. She got a chicken salad at an attached restaurant and was back in her Subaru 30 minutes later, enjoying a glorious sunset. Up ahead, Carrie noticed a red Ford F-150 truck pulled over to the side of the road. She checked for oncoming traffic, wanting to give the truck a wide berth as she passed. She was maybe 15 feet away when the Ford's engine revved, its taillights flashed, and the pickup spun out into the road in front of her. Carrie shrieked and slammed on the brakes, burning rubber that left long black trails behind her. She had been going 45 and avoided a rear bumper collision by inches. Carrie leaned hard on her horn to let the pickup driver know exactly what she thought of that maneuver. The F-150 sped on ahead, and Carrie released her white-knuckled grip on the steering wheel. Her hands trembled slightly as the adrenaline rush lingered. "What an asshole," Carrie muttered under her breath. The F-150's brake lights lit up as if the driver had heard her and wanted to escalate the confrontation. Carrie tapped on her brakes to keep distance, but the truck had slowed to a crawl, and the gap between them closed in a blink. Clenching her jaw tight enough to hurt, Carrie braked some more, but the truck had come to a near standstill. Before she knew it, the bumpers were almost touching. Carrie hit her horn again, but with a little less force. The beeps were meant to urge the driver to pick up speed, not show anger. She noticed the license plate was from Maine. Probably some local kids who did not take kindly to tourists who used the horn on them. The driver picked up speed, and Carrie did as well, but inexplicably the driver braked again. The next time it accelerated, Carrie kept some distance that she would use to try and pass on the left. She had no desire to play this obnoxious game for the remainder of her drive. She checked the traffic, moved over a lane, and gunned the accelerator to pass. All four of the Subaru's engine cylinders worked overdrive to pick up some speed. Carrie glanced to her right as she passed the truck, but the driver was just a shadow. She drove on ahead and felt her blood pressure spike when a check in her rear view showed the truck gaining. The truck was flashing its lights and slamming the horn. Carrie had one chilling thought. Road rage. She accelerated, but the more powerful pickup easily kept pace. The truck's horn blared and its headlights flashed. Carrie rolled down her window and waved her arm to encourage the pickup to pass. The truck gained speed but did not change lanes. The driver got so close to her Subaru the bumpers nearly kissed. Carrie's heartbeat accelerated. She brought her arm back inside her vehicle. If the driver was not going to pass, she might have to get to the side of the road and let him go by. A flash of fear came over her. What if she stopped and he did as well? There were no other cars on this stretch of highway. She checked her phone. No signal. Carrie could not imagine being in a more vulnerable position. She put her arm out the window and gave another urging wave. This time, the truck veered left into the oncoming lane, and then right, then left again, weaving down the road. Before Carrie could make sense of it, the pickup switched lanes and accelerated again. Carrie punched the gas, but the F-150 easily kept pace. They were driving alongside each other, but only the Ford was at risk for a head-on collision. Carrie dared a glance to her left and saw a single broad-shouldered driver in the cab. His face was an empty shadow, or so she believed. For a second, Carrie thought he had on a black mask. She did not get a chance for a better look. Panic gripped her. Carrie floored the accelerator around a sharp bend, and her car shot forward like a rocket. Her tires skidded, but never lost grip of the road. The Ford stayed in the left lane and kept pace as it inched closer to her car. She would have to leave the road to get any distance. Ahead was a long straight stretch of highway with no oncoming traffic. And again, Carrie leaned on her horn, giving it a long and angry blast, and then intentionally let up on the accelerator, hoping the Ford would decide to pass. The pickup's driver anticipated her plan somehow and slowed as well. The truck kept parallel to Carrie's car as it maneuvered yet another inch closer. The distance between them was no greater than a hair's width. Carrie heard a sudden and tremendous crack as the truck snapped off her side mirror. A piercing scrape of metal on metal followed. Instinctively, Carrie turned the wheel hard right as the pickup swerved away. She straightened out her course just as the pickup came back again. This time, the truck slammed into the side of her car. Carrie gave a yell and swung the wheel right. Her only thought was to get away from danger. She did not contemplate the consequences of making such a violent and sudden turn.
Once the skid started, it was not going to stop. Carrie screamed as her car veered off the highway going 40 and headed for a dense copse of trees. Everything was a blur of green. She heard tree branches snap violently and metal and glass shatter. There was a huge crash and a crack of splitting wood louder than thunder. Carrie's head snapped back, and she heard another sickening crunch of metal and plinking glass as the car stopped abruptly. A gunshot sound followed as the airbag deployed. It happened so fast, Carrie could not even register what hit her, but it felt as if somebody had slapped her face as hard as they could. Chalky dust went into her eyes and up her nose as she choked on a pungent stench. For a moment, Carrie could see nothing but the white of the airbag. But then the pain came, and the whiteness of the bag gave way to black. Chapter 42. Braxton Price and Curtis Gantry used the police scanner in the pickup to listen in on the aftermath of Carrie's accident. The accident drew two fire trucks, two police cruisers, and an ambulance to the scene. The driver was conscious and reported that a red Ford F-150 with main plates had driven her off the road. The APB included no plate number, so Carrie had not seen or could not recall it. Either way, Braxton was not worried about the police pulling them over. They were driving Gantry's blue Chevy pickup with Massachusetts plates. Braxton had ditched the Ford on a prearranged side street off Route 1, about 10 miles from where the accident occurred. Gantry had picked him up there, per the plan, and together they resumed the drive north. The whole operation had been improvised when they got word Carrie was headed to Maine. Braxton took the chopper north, secured a car to use, and got behind Carrie's Subaru with help of the chopper and Gantry, who had tailed Carrie all the way from Massachusetts. Braxton figured on taking her down near Bangor when she left the highway, but Carrie had opted for a scenic detour, so he and Gantry had arranged a different meeting place. It helped that Carrie had stopped for something to eat. Braxton was able to pull ahead and wait for her while Gantry got even farther down the road. The transition from one truck to the other took no time at all. Gantry was acting like a boy at the skate park, all smiles and pump full of adrenaline. He loved missions, any missions, but especially successful ones. "So she didn't die," he said. "Does that mean we get a bonus?" "No, it means we didn't screw up," Braxton said. "What's the worst thing that could have happened?" "We're about to permanently take out Rockwell. We don't need two docs going dark on the same day from the same hospital who happen to work for the same program. It's not the sort of coincidence our employers are interested in explaining away. What we did wasn't optimal, but we had to do something. Besides, she's still considered an asset to the program. At least that's the word from up high. I figured if Rockwell didn't die after we ran him off a cliff, Carrie could survive a little action in the trees. Maybe we got lucky here, but we did all right." Gantry went silent. He seemed almost reflective, though Braxton knew his friend's thoughts seldom strayed far from guns, sex, and money. "Good thing we had the bird in the sky," Gantry said. "I had lost her for a while there." "There are no helicopters where we're headed next, no backup either. We get caught, we've got to go dark ourselves. You carry?" From the pocket of his denim jacket, Gantry fished out a white pill the size of a Tic Tac and popped it into his mouth. "Hey, don't screw around with that," Braxton snapped. Gantry hid his teeth and pressed the cyanide capsule between his lips. He flashed Braxton a toothless smile.
"I think you're pretty, Braxton. You like me?"
"Get that out of your mouth before you bite it and die." Gantry spit the pill into his hand and tucked it back inside his jacket pocket.
"Who did you give the money to?"
he asked. "None of your damn business."
"I'm guessing it's Jesse."
"Guess all you want."
"How long since you've seen him?"
Braxton thought a beat.
"Maybe 5 years. Maybe more."
"So he's, what, 15 now?"
"Something like that."
Gantry gave a long, low whistle. "Imagine being that young and getting, what is it, $500,000? Just like that? Shit, if I had that kind of money at that age, I'd have screwed myself into a coma deeper than Rockwell's."
"He's not going to get the money because we're not going to get caught."
"Maybe I won't take the pill," Gantry said. "Who did you give the money to?"
"My mom," Gantry said. "So we get caught, you're dead regardless, and instead of your mom winning the lottery, somebody other than you will be planning her funeral. Look, Gantry, the poor woman had it hard enough raising your sorry ass.
Give her the peace of mind she deserves, man. Gantry nodded. He saw the logic in Braxton's thinking. Always did.
Speaking of peace, Carrie's got a great ass, Gantry said.
That's a different kind of peace, Braxton said.
Whatever. I'm just saying I followed her on a jog in Healy Park, and she has tremendous assets.
I'd love to tag that.
That's how you conduct surveillance.
Hey, man, I'm just doing my job. Checked out her room, too. Nothing there, but I did have a nice time laying down on her bed and thinking dirty thoughts.
Nobody saw you? Braxton asked.
Nah, man. Her brother's a drone. He was watching TV and didn't hear me come in. I think that guy could use the wires, if you get my drift.
Braxton shook his head dismissively, turned on the radio, and eventually found the local NPR station. Gantry listened for all of 3 minutes before he tired of hearing about the struggles of life in Libya and switched to a pop station.
You and your freaking NPR. I don't know how you listen to that crap.
We're like the odd couple, man, Gantry said.
Braxton shot Gantry an annoyed look.
Have you ever even seen that show? I know for sure you didn't read the play. Do you even know what you're talking about?
To Braxton's surprise, Gantry returned a broad, sloppy grin and hummed, in perfect tune, the opening bars to the show starring Tony Randall and Jack Klugman.
The internet has everything, asshole, Gantry said, and he resumed humming.
On they drove, speeding into the twilight on their way to Seacoast Memorial Hospital, with Gantry humming the Odd Couple theme as if it was his favorite show of all time. Gantry pulled into the hospital parking lot a little after 9 o'clock. The two-story, mostly brick structure appeared to be undergoing a major renovation, and Gantry drove around until he found a parking space out of the way, near a loading zone. He cut the engine, only after making sure that no surveillance cameras were around to record them. Meanwhile, Braxton maneuvered around inside the cramped cab and pulled off his loose-fitting sweats and t-shirt to reveal the green custodial uniform he wore underneath. He had in his possession an employee badge from Seacoast Memorial with his picture on it, but Lee Taggart's name. The uniform and badge were precautions taken a while back, as soon as they'd known Rockwell would be a patient at Seacoast Memorial for a while. In the shadows of some scaffolding, he checked his supplies, a syringe and a vial of clear liquid.
I'll be out in 10 minutes, Braxton said as he filled the syringe with liquid to the last marked line.
Gantry winked and blew Braxton a kiss.
Careful, sweetheart. I'll be thinking of you.
Braxton ignored him and headed for the main entrance. Inside the hospital, he flashed security his badge and continued on his way. No problems there. Braxton's badge opened all the doors, a modern miracle, courtesy of some supremely competent computer types who worked for his employers. Deep pockets bought a lot more than aerial surveillance. Braxton walked the halls until he found a janitor's cart, complete with a broom, cleaning supplies, and a 20-gallon vinyl bag for trash, tucked away in an unobtrusive nook. He wheeled the cart over to the long-term care wing on the first floor. The diffused fluorescent lighting, powerful stench of cleansers, beeps of various machines, and unpleasant stale air reminded Braxton of the VA. All hospitals were essentially the same, and the people who came to them were the same as well. They got better, got worse, or got dead. Braxton went in and out of several rooms, emptying the trash and wiping down furniture. The two duty nurses did not give him a second look. He was the help, one of the invisibles who worked behind the scenes to keep the place clean enough to cure.
Good evening, Braxton said to a stout nurse who sat behind a desk covered with monitors.
Same shit, different location.
Evening, the nurse said. She gave Braxton only a cursory glance before her focus returned to those monitors. Braxton wheeled his cart into Sam Rockwell's room. For a guy who had been in a coma for so long, Rockwell actually looked pretty good. The bruises and cuts had mostly healed, and he appeared to be sleeping peacefully. With practiced skill, Braxton injected succinylcholine intravenously and titrated the flow to speed up induction. Beneath the skin, invisible to the eye, Rockwell's muscles had begun to twitch in spasm. Almost immediately, Rockwell's heart rate accelerated to help get oxygen to the brain. But the neuromuscular blocker, widely used by anesthesiologists and easy for Braxton to procure, would stop that heart in short order. A patient as injured as Rockwell would not be subjected to an autopsy, Braxton had been told, and there was little chance of discovering the breakdown product, succinic acid.
Braxton counted to 30 before he wheeled his cart out of Rockwell's room and over to the nurse's station.
"I'm no doc," he said, "but that guy in there looks like he's having a real hard time breathing."
As if on cue, an alarm sounded. The nurse leapt up from her chair as though it were on fire and rushed into action. Braxton heard the code call come over the loudspeaker. A moment later, a crush of doctors and nurses headed for Rockwell's room like galloping racehorses. Braxton became invisible again as he wheeled the janitor's cart nonchalantly down the hallway, whistling the tune from The Odd Couple as he went. Chapter 43.
"It looks a lot worse than it feels," Carrie said. Using the tips of his fingers, gentle as possible, David touched the large bruised area that marred much of Carrie's right cheek. His face expressed sympathy and heartfelt concern. The Starbucks was packed at the bustling strip mall near the VA where the two had met. In less than an hour, Carrie was scheduled to see a demonstration of the virtual reality program that had sent Steve Abington off the rails. David had plans of his own at the hospital. Carrie removed her sunglasses to show David the full extent of her injuries, but bright sunshine stabbed her eyes, and she quickly slipped the shades back into place. The ER doc who had treated Carrie in Maine warned that her sensitivity to light might last a few weeks. After she showed the doc a picture of her crumpled Subaru, he added, "Be grateful that's your biggest concern." Carrie had spent a few days resting at home after the accident, but her body still ached in every conceivable way. Stiff joints, throbbing pain in her knees and wrists, tight muscles, pounding headache. David's touch, at least, made her forget the discomfort for a moment.
"I wish you'd called me from Maine," David said. "I would have come to get you."
Carrie had actually given the idea some measured consideration, but opted for her brother instead, in part because of vanity. Days after the accident, Carrie's left eye was still swollen. Her split lip not fully healed, and her nose, though not broken, looked like a doorknob squished on her face. Most of the damage was the result of the airbag deployment, but without it, Carrie knew her injuries could have been fatal. As for Adam, her brother had been incredibly supportive throughout the ordeal. He had dished out all the expected brotherly jabs. "You look hot," he'd said, and "it might be an improvement." But those had come later, on the drive home. The first thing he did was to give Carrie a long embrace, and the first words he spoke were, "I'm so grateful you're all right." Carrie managed to hold back the waterworks until Adam kissed her bruised forehead and told her how much he loved her. Howard's treasured BMW was off limits to all, so Adam drove Carrie home in their mother's Volvo.
"If I had that stupid Camaro running, I could have picked you up in style," he had said.
"I'm just glad you came," Carrie said.
"Anything for my favorite sister."
I'm your only sister."
"Yeah, semantics, whatever," Adam said.
During the drive home, Adam pulled alongside any red pickup truck so that Carrie could get a good look at the driver. She was almost glad it was never the guy who ran her off the road because her brother had a murderous look in his eyes. The Subaru was a total loss, so Carrie had co-opted her mom's Volvo to get to the VA. Arrangements to see the virtual reality demo were made with Cal Trent before the accident, and Dr. Finley had suggested they reschedule. Carrie convinced him otherwise. All DBS surgeries were on hold until Carrie was medically cleared to operate, and she felt useless just sitting around at home. More than anything, Carrie wanted to keep this appointment. Her suspicions were in full bloom, and she needed to learn more about the DARPA program post-haste. The best place to begin, she believed, was at the point in the process where those negative memories got reconsolidated. Carrie checked the time to make sure she was not running late for the demo. David saw her preparing to go and gave her a concerned look.
"Are you sure you shouldn't just be in bed?" he asked.
Carrie brushed aside the suggestion. "I'm fine, really." David read something in Carrie's eyes.
"You don't think it was road rage, do you?"
he asked. "A lot of things have happened since Abington and Fasciani went missing. The timing is more than a little unusual, don't you think?"
"But you told me Rockwell died of heart failure," David said.
The call with the sad news had come while Carrie was at the hospital waiting for Adam to show. Though she had never met Sam Rockwell in person, Carrie's emotions vacillated between stunned and heartbroken. The intensity of her feelings came as a surprise, but Carrie understood their origin. She and Rockwell were connected in ways that went beyond the operating room at the VA. Ways Carrie believed she was on the cusp of discovering.
His body was incredibly damaged, and for the heart to stop was not a shock to anybody. Normally, I would agree, but again, the timing makes me highly suspicious. I get run off the road, and suddenly he dies? Think about it.
What about an autopsy?
There's not going to be one, according to Dr. Smirling. The family doesn't want it, and I can't start spouting conspiracy theories. The best way to find out what really happened to Sam is to keep the pressure on Goodwin.
You really think there's a connection to Rockwell?
David asked. I don't think, Carrie said. I know.
You sure Goodwin's not around?
I checked her schedule. She's in an all-day meeting. Are you sure you can get inside her office? David fished out the lockpick kit from his pocket and showed it to Carrie with a smile.
Of course, he said. I have the key.
Carrie wore her lab coat, and for that reason alone garnered plenty of curious looks while navigating the halls of the VA. It was one thing to see an injured person in a hospital, but something else entirely when that individual also happened to be a doctor. It set people on edge. Dr. Finley, who had only spoken with Carrie by phone and had not seen her injuries, grimaced at the sight.
My goodness, he said, rising from his chair.
He gave Carrie a warm embrace that conveyed utter relief. It looks worse than it feels, Carrie said, repeating what she'd told David. It was the same lie she told everyone.
Well, I just hope they catch whoever did this to you.
Carrie thanked him, and he sat back down. Dr. Finley glanced at the letter on his desk, written on his personal stationery.
I've spent the last hour trying to figure out what to say to Sam's wife, he said. I'm just devastated. Nothing I write expresses how I really feel. I let my hopes get up when he came out of the coma, but now...
Dr. Finley slipped off his glasses and rubbed at his reddened eyes. Carrie got the feeling he had been crying.
Now I just have memories.
I'm so sorry for your loss. I wish I had gotten to know him.
We were pioneers in this together from the start, Dr. Finley said. We owe a lot to Sam. I owe a lot to him.
He sounded like a wonderful man, Carrie said, and then fell silent. If anything, her eyes were even wider, her expression more empathetic.
Listen, Alistair, there's something I'd like to talk with you about.
Dr. Finley noticed Carrie's apprehension.
You look upset, Carrie. Please take a seat. I'll let Cal know we're running a few minutes late.
Carrie's anxiety bubbled like uncorked champagne while Dr. Finley texted his message to Trent. He put his smartphone away and locked his gaze on Carrie.
Go on, he urged.
Although Carrie had planned what to say, the reality of the moment felt weighty and more difficult than anticipated.
My car accident happened in Maine, she began.
Yes, you said you were there following up on an Abington lead.
Yes and no, Carrie said. I was headed to the hospital to see Sam.
Dr. Finley looked confused.
Sam? Heavens, why?
Carrie said, I wanted to see if he'd ever seen palynacusis in a DBS patient before, specifically one of the PTSD patients.
Dr. Finley seemed mystified. Carrie watched him mull over the word palynacusis as if it was something he had heard before but could not put into any context. When it finally came to him, a surprised look came over his face.
Palynacusis? Good gracious, what on earth would make you want to ask him that?
Carrie explained her encounter with Abington and later with Fasciani, and noted how both patients had disappeared. She also revealed her own self-doubt about causing the auditory hallucination, in addition to the impaired judgment issues exhibited by both patients in their choice to leave the hospital AMA. When she finished, Dr. Finley said,
And you thought you caused all this?
In a way that absolved Carrie of any responsibility.
I admit my confidence was shaken when I started working here, and when they both presented with palynacusis, well, I naturally questioned my technique.
To be honest here, Carrie, Dr. Finley said in an even tone, I think you're reading symptoms that simply aren't there. Palynacusis? I've treated dozens of vets here and haven't seen a single case reported. And you watched me examine Ramon Hernandez. Did he seem off to you?
No, Carrie said. Not at all.
Dr. Finley's puzzlement remained.
I've never seen a case of that in my whole career, and it's been a long career. But I have seen your work, and it's exemplary.
There's no way you caused anything like that in these men. Impossible.
Carrie was not ready to back off. What about the connection between Ramon Hernandez and Steve Abington? She said. The two had met. I told you about the picture at Rita Abington's home.
Dr. Finley was unmoved. I spoke to Cal about that, and he did some digging. Steve was referred to the DARPA program through other channels, so their knowing each other is just a coincidence, that's all. But you can speak to Cal on that if you like.
Carrie agreed. For a moment, she contemplated sharing her belief that Lee Taggart, the VA nurse, was also in the same photograph, but the evidence was not conclusive enough for her to stake that claim. Dr. Finley leaned forward in his chair and set his hand over Carrie's in an avuncular gesture. In that moment, her convictions fell away, and she felt foolish for confiding in Dr. Finley without first obtaining proof to support her claims. If only she had found those men.
What about both Abington and Fasciani leaving AMA? Carrie asked.
Dr. Finley shrugged it off. Carrie, these men were unstable to begin with. And we exacerbate that problem by agitating them with the virtual reality.
Carrie saw the logic, but was not quite ready to back away. And my getting run off the road and Sam dying on the same day? You don't see any connections there?
Dr. Finley leaned back in his chair and cast Carrie a look of shock and disgust. His expression conveyed his belief that her insinuations bordered on the absurd.
You said yourself it was road rage. Honestly, Carrie, I'm more worried I hired a conspiracy theorist than anything else. To be candid, I see you drawing a lot of lines between events that have no logical connections.
Carrie decided it was time to beat a hasty retreat. Dr. Finley was visibly bothered by her theory, his head shaking in disbelief. Several psychological causes explained conspiracy theorists, including anxiety disorders, paranoia, and psychosis. None of those labels would do her or her career any good. While Carrie was not willing to abandon her search for the missing link that would connect these strange happenings in some logical manner, she would have to wait for the answers. Other questions of hers would have to wait as well. Was the jogger in the park really as harmless as he professed? Had someone other than Adam been in her room? Perhaps Dr. Finley was right, and those were unrelated events as well, but Carrie was not ready to concede. Surely the Goodwin recordings would reveal something, something that would convince Dr. Finley she was not a theorist at all. Dr. Finley gathered his composure and stood.
So, can we put this behind us for the moment and concentrate on getting you better and getting us back to work? He asked. I want to finish what Sam and I started. We're on the verge of something important here, Carrie, and I'd rather focus our energies on the patients who want our help and not on those who walked away.
Yes, Carrie said. I feel better just talking it out.
Good, Dr. Finley said, clapping his hands together. Now then, let's send you to war.
Chapter 44. Carrie's stomach knotted when Dr. Finley pushed open the conference room door. What would she see through the looking glass? Would it help her better understand Adam, give her a glimpse into his world of constant fear? She could hardly imagine how horrible the simulation must have been, how real, how visceral, to elicit such a violent and disturbed reaction in Abington. It was ironic, Carrie thought, that before she joined this endeavor to cure PTSD, she'd had no profoundly disturbing memories. Nothing of real substance she could draw upon as fodder for simulation. Now she had a whole host of experiences to use. On the long table inside the windowless conference room, Carrie saw a laptop computer and some futuristic eyewear, a cross between ski goggles and wraparound sunglasses. The eyewear was connected to the laptop via a USB port. Calvin Trent stood to greet Carrie and Dr. Finley, wearing a blue suit that fit snugly against his broad shoulders. With Trent was the bald man Carrie had seen at Grand Rounds. Trent extended a hand to Carrie, warmth entering his gray eyes.
Nice to see you again, he said.
It was then he noticed Carrie's face.
Goodness, what happened to you?
Carrie said, car accident.
Trent grimaced in solidarity.
Well, I'll make sure there are no car crashes in your simulation. I can imagine you have a little PTSD already from that experience. Wouldn't want to make things worse.
Carrie gave a little laugh. Yeah, let's do that, she said. Trent turned to his companion.
This is Bob Richardson,
he said. He's been helping with operations. Bob, this is Dr. Alistair Finley and Dr. Carrie Bryan with the VA.
Carrie watched Dr. Finley shake hands with Richardson for what appeared to be the first time, confirming her earlier belief that he had not been introduced to her at the Grand Rounds simply because the two had never met before. A related question popped into Carrie's mind. How many people are involved with this program? She asked. Trent said,
I'd say with all the technicians and medical staff and such, we're probably close to 100.
Close to 100? Carrie repeated. Where is everybody?
Spread out, Trent said. We don't have an official base of operations just yet. Believe it or not, the government is always looking to save a buck or two, so to minimize costs, we utilize the workspace of our experts and consultants whenever possible. I explained to Carrie that there's a lot more going on here than just neurology and neurosurgery, Dr. Finley said.
Trent nodded in agreement.
That's correct. We have psychologists, physiologists, simulation technicians, a wide variety of specialists involved. There are even plans in the works for building a dormitory or semi-permanent housing, but for now, vets in the program who come to us without a permanent residence have to settle for Motel 6, which is a lot nicer than the streets where most of them had been living. We have contracts in place with the car service to shuttle our program participants to all their various appointments.
Richardson said,
having everything decentralized does create some operational challenges.
I can't imagine driving Abington anywhere without an armed guard, Carrie said. The memory of Abington's assault replayed in her mind.
I heard you had a terrible experience there,
Richardson said in a sincerely apologetic tone. Carrie said, that's for sure.
Trent said, we intentionally run the simulation on the premises here at the VA to minimize travel time. Once the DBS system is installed, most of the vets are a lot more docile, I can assure you. But I'm sorry about what happened to you.
I'm assuming that you know he's gone, Carrie said to Trent. Fasciani, too. Both vanished. Trent grimaced.
Yes, I'm aware. We're looking for both of them. Many in our program have issues with alcohol and drugs, which can lead to all sorts of erratic behavior.
They left AMA, Carrie said. We signed them out. Trent looked at Dr. Finley.
Yes, Alistair told me. In fact, we have a meeting scheduled with Dr. Goodwin to come up with better protocols moving forward. We don't want this to become a trend. We're too close to finishing phase 3.
What's the next phase? Carrie asked.
Full deployment of the solution, tested, validated, and FDA sanctioned. It's the game changer,
Trent said. Bob Richardson manipulated the laptop and did something to make the screen turn black.
We're ready whenever you are, Cal, he said.
Richardson spoke in a hard, dry voice. It was the voice of someone accustomed to commanding a crowd. He did not strike Carrie as a subordinate.
Who was this guy, really? Are you ready, Carrie?
Trent asked. Carrie had that funny feeling in the pit in her stomach that preceded any roller coaster ride.
Sure thing, she said. We're using a simulation from one of our program participants, Richardson said. But for privacy reasons, I'm not at liberty to tell you which one.
Carrie smiled politely. Of course, I understand. Carrie took a seat at the conference table with Richardson on her right, Trent on her left, and Dr. Finley across from her. The goggles were lightweight and fit over Carrie's head with minimum adjustments required. The earbuds slipped right into place. Through the lens, Carrie could see only black.
Are you ready?
Trent's voice was slightly muffled, but clear enough for Carrie to give him a thumbs-up sign. Blackness gave way to light, and a desert scene unfolded in Carrie's view. A digitally rendered lone figure stood on a bridge that crossed over a sand-covered road. What appeared to be palm trees stood in the background, with a few scattered tufts of vegetation. In front of the bridge were two heavily armed and armored Humvees, and behind those vehicles were two kneeling soldiers, each holding automatic weapons. While shadows and lighting enhanced the reality of the 3D graphics, the scene itself still looked like something out of a video game. Adam could no longer play Call of Duty, but Carrie had seen him shooting up the enemy enough times to be reminded of a lightweight version of that game. The sound of Humvee engines rumbled in Carrie's ear, and the graphics began to move. First, the kneeling soldiers stood, and then the Humvees inched ahead. Carrie turned her head from side to side, but her field of view remained unchanged. This was more like watching a computer-generated movie than the total immersion experience she had expected. The Humvees rolled under the bridge, with the two soldiers bringing up the rear. There was movement from the figure on the bridge, and Carrie saw him using what appeared to be a cell phone. The animation was close to the natural arcs and curves of the human body, but not quite there. In her headphones, Carrie heard the sound of an explosion, and in the next instant, the ground in front of the lead Humvee became a debris field. The now mangled Humvee lifted several feet above the virtual ground before it crash-landed hard on four tires. The graphics showed the vehicle's shock absorbers doing their job as the wheels bounced several times before they finally settled. Dust and sand kicked skyward, but it was still video game dust and sand. While the whole sequence was surprising, Carrie did not find it overly frightening or hyper-realistic. The gunmen on foot returned fire and shot at the man on the bridge, while three burned and bleeding soldiers crawled out from the wrecked Humvee. The graphics were well done, and Carrie could see that two of the men had lost limbs, one an arm and the other a leg. The third soldier to climb out bled profusely from a head wound. A second explosion followed. This one swallowed one of the two soldiers on foot. When that virtual dust cleared, the sand beneath the soldier's body was colored red, and he was without limbs. The surviving soldier fired at the man on the bridge, this time striking him somewhere, torso, head. It was difficult for Carrie to tell. The dead insurgent tumbled off the bridge and landed on the desert sand with a thud. The scene faded to black, and Carrie removed her headset. Richardson appraised Carrie as if she might need to be sedated like Abington.
"Well, I hope that wasn't too traumatic for you," he said.
Carrie removed the earbuds and stared down at her lap for several seconds. When she looked up, Carrie's face showed signs of strain and her composure was compromised. "If you recreated my car accident, I'd be in tears right now," Carrie said. "I can only imagine what the soldiers go through after seeing their own worst nightmares replayed on screen." Carrie glanced around the room and felt confident everyone believed her lie. She had expected so much more from the simulation, based on Abington's violent reaction. Dr. Finley said, "The reconsolidation of the negative memory is a necessary, albeit unfortunate, step in the process. With the memory fresh in the mind, we can use electric stimulation to remove the emotion associated with the event. Ramon Hernandez can watch his virtual reality simulation now like it's the movie of the week, when before it would have sent him into a violent rage." Carrie believed Adam could see a similar demo of his traumatic experience in Afghanistan, and while it might add a few notches to his blood pressure, that would be it. It was simply not believable enough, in her estimation, to incite such a strong emotional reaction. Carrie recalled the crazed look in Abington's eyes just before the attack, as well as the mysterious words he had uttered. "I don't belong here. I don't belong." What had Trent really done to him prior to surgery? By now, David had probably retrieved the recording device. Carrie could hardly wait to see him, to share what she had learned during the demo, and to listen in on Goodwin's private conversations. She had a strong feeling they would reveal something significant.
"Amazing. I'm really impressed," Carrie said. "Cal and Bob, I want to thank you for taking the time to arrange this demo for me. It really did open my eyes."
"You're very welcome," Trent said. "We view you as a vital part of this team, Carrie. I speak for Bob and the rest of the DARPA organization when I say how grateful we are to have you on board. And not to be glib here, but I'm also hopeful you'll be able to operate with your injuries. If you asked Alistair, he'd say you're one of the best surgeons he's ever worked with. Everyone is simply devastated about what happened to Sam, but if we had to replace him, we're glad it's you at the helm."
Carrie returned a slight smile, no teeth showing. "I'm glad to be a part," she said. "And thank you for the endorsement. I really do appreciate it."
Carrie took out her phone and pretended to type a message. In reality, she had snapped a photo of Bob Richardson. With David's help, she hoped they could figure out who he really was. Chapter 45. Gabby, the little girl with pigtails, gave Carrie a delightful gap-toothed smile and hugged her knees only because she was not tall enough to reach higher. Gabby's surprise embrace tugged at Carrie's heart. This complete sweetie pie paid no attention to Carrie's injuries. To her innocent eyes, Carrie was just a friend of her Uncle David, as she called him. Nothing more. There was no judgment, no pretense, nothing but total acceptance. Carrie's heart warmed more when Gabby turned to David and gazed up at him with wide-eyed reverence.
Can you play with me?
Gabby asked.
In a little bit, sweetheart, David said. I have some grown-up talk to do first.
Emma and Gabby had come up to David's apartment a minute or so after Carrie had arrived. At first, Carrie felt a spark of jealousy when she saw how pretty Emma was, how put together she seemed in her hip-hugging jeans and cute turquoise top. But the feeling passed quickly. Emma and David had an undeniable intimacy, but Carrie got the vibe it was not based on any romantic love. Try as she might, Carrie could not quite figure out what David did not see in Emma, or Emma and David, but she was not going to question it. She knew what she felt for David, and she suspected he felt the same. Something was going to happen between them. She could see it in the way he looked at her, and feel it in the way his look made her skin tingle. David took Carrie's phone and sent Emma the picture she'd taken. Emma glanced at her phone's display and showed the photo to David and Carrie for confirmation. This is the guy? The picture Carrie had taken included part of Cal Trent, but Bob Richardson was front and center.
That's him, David said. How good is the facial recognition software at the DMV?
Very good, Emma said. We're required to run a one-to-many comparison before issuing a driver's license, permit, or ID. What's a one-to-many comparison? Carrie asked. Emma said, one-to-many compares photos of an applicant with all the other customers on file at DMV. We get alerted if there are possible matches between customers under different names. We examine the possible matches to determine whether it's simply very similar-looking individuals or possibly the same individual under different names.
Sounds good to me, David said.
Me too, Carrie said. But what if he's not a licensed Massachusetts driver? Emma shrugged. We have a new data sharing initiative to give law enforcement agencies more access to our data. I've helped with the rollout, so I have contacts who could do a search for me if I don't get any local hits. I used it before to locate Rita Abington's address. Give me a few days on this, Emma said.
Thanks, David said. I really appreciate it.
Emma collected Gabby from the toy corner, and together they left David's apartment with some substantial protests that could be heard while the pair descended the stairs. She's such a cutie pie, Carrie said.
She's the best, David said. Her dad doesn't know what he's missing.
Carrie suspected David would make a terrific father, someone who would be patient, kind, and capable. The thought made him more attractive to her. David's cozy apartment was similar to her old place in Brookline. It was bright, airy, and sparsely furnished. She wanted to take a closer look at the many photographs lining his wall, but that would have to wait. They had business to discuss.
Tell me about the VR before we listen to the recording, David said.
Carrie recounted her experience in the neurology unit conference room in considerable detail. David seemed troubled by what he heard.
There was no position tracking,
he asked after she had finished. No, it was more like watching a movie. The view didn't change when I moved my head.
This is DARPA, David said, sounding incredulous. You'd think they would have the most sophisticated technology available, a completely immersive experience.
That's what I thought, too. Something didn't seem right about it.
Let's have a listen to those recordings, David said.
He set up the two portable speakers on a scuffed coffee table and plugged in a connecting cable. While this was going on, an orange tabby cat, padded out from the bedroom, gracefully leapt from the floor onto the sofa and immediately began to knead the cushion with its claws.
That's Basra, David said. This is her favorite spot. Well, mine too. We nap here a lot.
Within a few seconds, the cat had condensed into a tight ball so that no part of its body existed outside the beam of sunlight that streamed through the tall bay window. Basra purred delightedly when Carrie scratched behind the ears. How long have you had him? Carrie asked.
Her, David corrected. About a year. She's a rescue.
Carrie imagined David and Basra taking long naps together on this very couch and believed it had enough room for all three to partake. As if reading her thoughts, David sat down on the other side of Carrie so Basra would not be disturbed. He pressed play on the recording device, and a burst of static gave way to the sound of a phone ringing.
It's noise activated, David explained, so there may be a lot of ringing phones before we hear any actual dialogue. Hopefully, we won't have to listen to your colleague Evan having sex.
Carrie knew all about Evan's sexcapades in Goodwin's office, as well as David's gravity-defying stint underneath the desk. It was a glimpse into the lengths he would go for the story and gave Carrie a keener understanding of how David had ended up a prisoner of the Syrian opposition forces.
The recorded phone rang once more. Somebody answered on the second ring and